Okay, this is July 28, 1990, and I'm here with Bernie Carbo. And Bernie, in the years between 69 and 80 during your playing career, you played with six different clubs. And what did it affect, did so many changes in teams have on your career, and would you say on your life in general?
Well, I think the experience of moving from city to city didn't affect me whatsoever. I had one baby born in St. Louis, one born in Boston, one born in Milwaukee. The traveling and experience that I gained by playing with other teams, I enjoyed tremendously because I got the opportunity to play with the Big Red Machine. I met guys like Pete Rose, Tony Perez, Lee May, and some of the great ball players of the Cincinnati Reds. I also was with the St. Louis Cardinals, and I ended up playing with the Lou Brock, Joel Torre, Bob Gibson, Ted Sizemore, and eventually I went to the Red Sox with Carl Yastrzemski, one of the superstar players, and went to Milwaukee with Hank Aaron. And fortunate enough, we go back as far as 69, I even played with Satchel Paige. So the experience that you gain by playing with other players, I met other personalities, I met players that I looked up to when I was a kid. So I thought it was an adventure for me that I enjoyed. But the thing that really hurt me the most, if you look back at my career, I don't think too many people realize that in 1970 and 69, I was Rookie of the Year, Minor League Player of the Year, played in the World Series. The following 2 years of 71 and 72, because of the way the contracts were negotiated, the Cincinnati Reds held me out of spring training for two complete years after my rookie year. So in 1973 was actually the first year I had in spring training, a full year of spring training. I came out and hit 286. So the effect that I had that hurt me the most in my career was not that I moved around, it was that I missed 2 years of spring training early in my career when I was young. And it was a matter of just dollars and cents, where back then they'd send the contract to the commissioner. The commissioner would sign it and send it back to the club, and you played for that, or you went and carried a lunch bucket. So I would say that back when I played, it was the things that hurt me the most was not the moving and playing with other teams. It was the negotiation, you know, negotiating and things like this. And the other things that hurt me too is when I was traded in the middle part of the year. That was difficult for my family and my wife and my children.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I noticed that that happened four different times in your career where you ended up playing for two teams in the same year.
That was hard. Now, the first couple times it happened to me, I could adjust. My wife was real good about it and my children were good. They were young enough that we could do this because they weren't in school. Then in 76, after the 75 World Series home run, I was traded to Milwaukee, and it took me 22 days to report, where I think you're supposed to report within 72 hours. Well, I took 22 days. I was ready to quit that year. I was at the home run in the World Series, which I was on cloud nine, and next thing I know, I took a 20% cut in pay, and I was traded. And my wife was 9 months pregnant, and I just bought a house. So I think that, at that sense, I think when a player is traded in the middle of the year, it is difficult for him.
Was that the only trade in your career where you really reacted negatively to the trade? Or did you ever react negatively if you went from a winning team to a team that wasn't so good?
No, there was another time, too. I acted negative when I went to Milwaukee in 76 because I wanted to stay with the Red Sox. The other time, again, I was traded from the Red Sox to the Cleveland Indians. I thought I was going to end up my career. I wanted to quit that year, too, but my wife talked me into going to Cleveland. I ended up with St. Louis, but those were times where I enjoyed the most in my career was the Boston Red Sox with Mr. Yawkey and Mrs. Yawkey, the way they treated us, and we were treated as a human being that we felt part of the uniform, part of the family, and part of the city, and it was a lot of fun to play it that way, because as you know, when you grow up as a kid, as an amateur, you play to win, you play for the uniform, you play for your team, and when you finally realize that you're not a part of the team, you're just someone who's out there, and if you can't participate, they'll get somebody else.
The event that you mentioned in your career that is probably most remembered by fans is that dramatic three-run homer in Game 6 of the 75 World Series, which saved the Red Sox from losing the series in that game. What are your recollections of that game today?
I was at an old-timers game, which we're doing today, and Jimmy Pearsall said, well, if you didn't hit that home run, Bernie, you wouldn't be here. And I said, yeah, but I did hit it. And he is right. In that ball game, we came up with a situation where we were down by 3 runs and Raleigh Eastwick was pitching. I pinched hit for Roger Moret and 2 men on. I worked the count to 3-2 and probably had one of the worst swings in baseball as I was looking at a fastball and he threw a slider. And Bench, at the time, the umpire called it the ball and then Thurst fouled it off out of his glove and John was arguing with the umpire that the pitch was a strike. Well, I stepped out of the box, got myself back together and I was looking for fastball. And Raleigh threw it out over the plate, and when I hit the ball, I didn't think the ball was going to be out of the park until I saw Geronimo turn his back. As I rounded second base and got close to third, I'm yelling at Pete, "Don't you wish you were that strong?" And he's yelling back, "This is fun, this is fun, this is what the World Series is about." But playing against the Cincinnati Reds and being a part of that organization for so long, that World Series made it a lot of fun for me because I knew everybody in the other club. And it also was a revenge thing, too, as the Cincinnati Reds hurt my career earlier in my years, like I told you. And now when I was 20, 21, 22, and 23, I only had 1 year of spring training. And as my salary went, I went 10, 12, 15, and 17. So I never made over the minimum salary. And back that time, so I looked back, and it was with Rico Cardi today. I was telling him, I says, I went to Winter Ball for 3 months. Paid for my apartment, my transportation, my car, and made more money in 3 months than I did in the big leagues. So it didn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, that's amazing. Tell me on the light side about your good luck charm, Mighty Joe Young.
Mighty Joe Young was given to me by Scipio Spinks when I was with the Cardinals. I got traded to the Red Sox, and I opened up a box he mailed to me in spring training, and he sent me the monkey in best regards, and he brought me some luck. But well, I think we carried the monkey around. At that time, he bought the monkey because he had a sore arm. He had a rotator cuff injury, and as I was telling before, clubs didn't care about you personally, just go out and win games. And he had a rotator cuff injury, and they brought in a psychiatrist to tell him that his arm was only hurting in his mind. And in Atlanta, Georgia, we were playing, and I took him to the doctors, and he had x-rays taken, and it was a rotator cuff injury. And they tried to tell him that he was pitching, that the soreness was in his mind, so they brought a psychiatrist. And so the psychiatrist, Scipio bought the monkey to bring into the psychiatrist room to say, "Here, you talk to the monkey. I don't want to talk to you anymore." So when he mailed it to me, it was just a form of a good luck piece for me, but it also showed that the management, this is what we were being used as, pretty much treated as Mighty Joe. So we dressed Mighty Joe up and took him on the planes and took him on the road trips with us, took him to restaurants and things, and it was a lot of fun.
One of the other fun things that I'm sure you recall from the Red Sox days is your teammate, Bill Lee. And he was both a teammate and a friend of yours and had the nickname Spaceman. What, in your recollection, are some of the things that you recall that might have earned him that name?
Well, Bill, if we were sitting here talking after a ball game, I didn't understand how a writer could listen to what Bill was saying and put it in the paper and believe it. So that's when I started believing that when you pick up a paper, there's not much you can believe that is written in the paper, because he'd start talking about it, politics and the animals, that the whale saved the whale, and we just lost a tough game 3-2 to somebody, and played the extra innings and maybe lost 4 or 5 games in a row. And he wasn't really concerned about talking about the game. He would just keep on talking and talking about other things. He's a very intelligent man. I always have liked Bill. I admire Bill for his abilities and things. And he's very outspoken, and he's a very dear friend of mine. And I look at Bill as, when he went out to the mound, was a very serious person. He pitched well, he went out there to win, and he worked hard at his game. He's the one that got me into getting myself completely in shape. He started me jogging and weightlifting and conditioning myself. And I wish I'd have met him earlier in my career, because he's a great guy.
Well, in fact, when the Red Sox sold you to Cleveland in 78, Bill Lee walked out at the time, did he not?
Well, like he said to me, he says, "Don't flatter yourself. I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for all of baseball." Because at that time, he realized I just bought a home. My wife was 9 months pregnant. We sat in the clubhouse on the deadline. We thought the deadline was midnight in the New England area. And I've already talked to the ball club, the owners, the general manager, the manager, and explaining my situation. I already had 2 little babies. My wife was pregnant with our 3rd one. I just moved in the house. We had the doctor, nurses, and everything. This trade, there was no way that I could possibly move without my wife having a baby. And Bill knew this, too. And And when the organization did not have the guts and enough to tell us in the clubhouse, it was a day game, and we sat there all night till midnight. As I got home, the phone rang, and I looked at my wife, and I said, I just been traded. And it was Don Zimmer, and that was Dell Johnson, and he says, yes, we traded you to the Milwaukee Brewers. And that was hard to stomach, and at that time, Bill knew that there was no way I could make that move. And he did not quit for me, he quit for all of baseball. And what he tried to prove to people was that we are individuals, we have a life of our own, we are human, we do have feelings, and we have to take care of our families. And it's not right to be uprooted in the middle part of the season where we establish our homes and our way of life and doing for the city and things like that. And it's not right to uproot a family and have someone have to report someplace in 72 hours and start their lives over again. And it was difficult. And Bill just wanted to show people in all of baseball that when we break north with a team, you leave with the 25 best players. And you should be able to stay with that within those means of those 25 players and work throughout your organization, playing players up to the minor leagues. That's why I like to see now written in the paper where it's difficult to make trades today because of the way the contracts are written up and the no-trade clauses and stuff. And the reason players did this is protect themselves, their family, and you have children in school, it's difficult to uproot them. And if you have to leave your family and kids behind, that's not fair either. So I think, Bill, the reason he quit was to show the people that we do have a life and we are human beings and we should be treated in that way and not treated like a piece of beef in the sense that you can hurt us all over the country.
Very true. Let's return to the American League days. You were frequently used as a designated hitter and as a person who played in that capacity for as long as you did. I'd like to know whether or not you believe that being used as a DH helped or hurt your career.
Well, it definitely helped my career. I was never a fleet-footed ball player that ran fast. I had a good glove, but I was an average glove. I wasn't a great outfielder, but I wasn't a bad outfielder. So the designated hitter helped my career because one of the things that I could do well was hit. And coming off the bench, I could hit the ball out of the park, I could DH, I could pinch hit. So the designated hitter had prolonged my career in a sense. In the National League, I didn't see much playing time because at the end of my career, I went there and there wasn't a designated hitter. And you're playing on AstroTurf, so you need the speed. And again, my arm at the end of my career wasn't as strong as it was when I was young, so the designated hitter helped my career. And if you look at it, it also pays another family member of in the big leagues, it pays for another person. Because pitchers aren't paid to hit, they're paid to pitch and to win ball games. So
you're a real proponent of the DH?
Yeah, I like the DH.
Would you like to see it extended to the National League?
Well, somewhat I would. Yeah, I'd like to see it in the National League, but I don't ever think it's going to happen.
Why do you say that?
I think the National League likes to be the premier league, and I think that they always thought the American League was a secondary league. And this has gone back to the days of the 20s, and when they just used to throw the glove out in the field, and when the American League started, it didn't exist. But I don't think the National League could do it. I wouldn't want to see it, because I still like both ideas of the game. I like the DH, and yet in the National League, I like the way they play because it's more situation of hit and runs and bunting the guy over and more strategies. And with the DH, you're just going out there pounding the ball.
Okay. You played on teams in Cincinnati, Boston, St. Louis that had some very big stars that you named earlier, Rose, Bench, Perez, Yastrzemski, Scott, Gibson, and many others. Do you feel that it's more difficult for a young player to get attention and recognition in a situation where he comes to teams with that caliber of existing star?
Well, if you look at that existing star, he had to establish himself just like anybody else did. So as a young player, it benefits if you have more stars because it takes the pressure off you. If you come onto a ball club that's young and doesn't have as many star players, the pressure is given to the other players and the younger players to produce and to win games. With the older players, they've been there before and experienced it, and they're going to take the pressure off you because they're the ones you look up to do the job.
And did they, in fact, take the pressure off you?
Sure. They were great people. Like I said, the players that you just mentioned, especially Carl Yastrzemski. Carl was probably the best superstar player that I ever played with. His sense of humor, he was funny, took a lot of pressure off, and He was the type of guy that in the clubhouse, he was always a prankster. But when the game started, he always said, if we go out between the lines, we're out there to win.
Did you ever see situations where ego or jealousies got in the way of playing the game?
Not among players. I don't think you see that. I think today players, when we played, if you won, you received a raise. If you hit 300 and lost, you didn't get a raise. So it was a matter of winning the championship and getting the World Series. And today I think it's an individual sport where you go out and you perform, you hit your 25, 30 home runs, you don't care if you win or lose. You hit 300, steal your bases. And it's an individual sport where I don't think the team effort and the team camaraderie is not there. I mean, to me, it's not important to win today, even though as an athlete, you do go out to win. Mm-hmm. But it's your performance is what counts the most today.
Is there anything about your career, other than being traded in mid-season, that you would change if you had to do all over again?
I don't think I'd change anything in myself. The only thing I would become is probably more selective in my friends. Because some people are jealous, and there are things that should be said. That there's a saying in our clubhouse that what is said here will be left here and will not be spoken outside these rooms.
And you feel that
I'm a
violated.
Firm believer. And I think it's been violated by a lot of ball players in the books they've written and things that have been said by other players. I think that's it's wrong. I mean, it is supposed to be said only in the clubhouse and not outside the clubhouse. So when I look back then, I'd be more selective than my friends and some of the ball players that I would probably more or less maybe even become a little bit more of a loner. But I was a free spirit person, and I enjoyed everybody's company, and I made friends with most everybody.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about the different managers that you played for? For example, who do you consider the best, and how did they differ?
I liked Sparky Anderson. He was the type of manager that platooned a lot. It didn't affect my career at all. I enjoyed it myself. It gave me a couple of days off. And I liked Don Zimmer. Don Zimmer was one of my favorite people. I loved playing with Don Zimmer. Don Zimmer liked me, and I liked him. He played me a lot, and I played with him in the minor leagues. He was my minor league manager, and I enjoyed his company. I really did. Don Zimmer, to me, was a father image for me. He took care of me when I was young, and as I got older, we had maybe a disagreement, and not a disagreement, but I think he saw things wrong when Bill Lee criticized Don Zimmer as being somewhat anti-pitching personality. He didn't like, maybe because he was beaned a couple times, but Don Zimmer was my favorite manager.
Mm-hmm. How important, in your estimation, is the manager to the success of a team?
Manager wins two or three games, maybe loses four or five.
Mm-hmm.
So the manager, to me, is a 500. It's the one time when I remember Carl Yastrzemski saying that Daryl Johnson was our manager at that time. He says, we had a private meeting, and we said, boys, we win the games ourselves, so let's play for ourselves and go out and win. We don't need direction. We don't need anyone to teach us how to win. Let's go out and win. And that was 1975.
You played in so many different cities, but I'm sure the one that had the most intense media coverage was Boston. And let me ask you, does the intensity, that level of intensity, affect the player's performance?
I think it helps your performance. If you ever been to Fenway Park, you'd see why. The fans are right on top of you. I enjoy that ballpark. It's like playing in Broadway. I felt that when you left the Boston Red Sox as a player and went to play elsewhere, your career was over with because there was no other place to play. And that was for playing in Fenway, the fans, the New England area, Mr. Yawkey. It was a great place to play. I enjoyed it there more so than any other place. And I would take Fenway, you say, you can look at the old Chicago Cubs ballpark, the Detroit Tigers ballpark, Comiskey ballpark. All the older ballparks have personalities, and you go in, and there's closeness there. You're close to the fans, and it's a lot more fun playing than the new stadiums. When you walk around, you can't even see a fan. I mean, they're so far away from the playing area. So I love Fenway. And being in the press and things like this, me being a little bit of a hot dog anyway, I mean, I like the press.
Great. One final question, Bernie. How would you like baseball fans to remember Bernie Carbo?
I like a fun-loving guy, a guy that enjoyed himself, went out and played hard, played to win. And I think this is the type of player I was. I wasn't afraid to get my uniform dirty, break up a double play, run into a wall. It was more important for me to play for fans, the Boston Red Sox, the city, and I had the winning attitude. I think that's what Carl Yastrzemski liked so much about me, that he knew when I went between the lines, the most important thing was winning. And that's how I like to see people think of Bernie Carbo as the winner.
Thanks very much, Bernie. That was great.
All right, Bob, thank you.
I'll tell you, that...
Hey, Willie!
That really made my day. Okay, Rico, you were telling us how Dixie Walker had helped your hitting.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. When they first invited me to spring training in 1964, which I didn't think I was ready to play in the big leagues, Dixie Walker called me one day, and Paul Richard told him to show me how he teach Mario Lu to, you know, make contact with the ball, because I was strong. But I used to strike out a lot. And he told me one day, he said, Ricky, I'm going to make you a 300 hitter. I'm going to take over the long ball from you, but you're still going to hit 15 odd home runs. But I'm going to make you a 300 hitter. And we argued, and he told me, you got to do what I say if you want to be in the big league. So he took me down to the batting cage, and he had me down there for about a month. And he made me shot the bat at first. It was so awkward, you know, shot the bat, a big man like me. I used to say, people are going to laugh at me. And he used to say to me, Rico, they're not going to laugh at you because they're going to be surprised that when a pitcher is tough and he gets you in two strikes, he's the one that's going to be surprised out there because all you're going to do is, I'm going to tell you, all you have to do is just make contact. Don't try to hit the ball out of the ball in two strikes. Just make contact. I said, well, I can't do it. He said, yes, you can. He took me down there for almost a month, and he had me day out and day in. And sometimes you see me do it, and I say, no, I'm not going to. And I keep, he keep on pushing me for that whole month. And when he thought I was ready, he said, Rico, he said,
then I can give you.
He said to me, he said, Rico, you ready? I said, I think so.
And
what organization was that?
Atlanta Braves.
Atlanta Braves?
It was Milwaukee Braves at the time.
Milwaukee Braves?
Yeah.
You played in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I played in Milwaukee 64 and 65.
That was a good hitter's ball,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, when he told me I was ready, I know I was ready, but still, I had a doubt in my mind, okay, that I could have hit that way. For the first one that I faced, Bobby Braggin called me in the seventh inning. He took out Hank Aaron and put me in right field. So he put the pressure on me. And Drysdale got me in two strikes with men in first and third. And he got me in two strikes, and I shot my bat. And next thing I know, he threw me that sinker low and away, and I just went up the right field. Bam! Double. Dixie Walker, the first one, was jumping up in this grandstand. I told you, Rico, I told you can do it. And he looked at Paul Richard, and Paul Richard smiled. I came in and said, Rico, I told you can do it. And don't you quit now. So I keep on hitting like that, and that's when I became the type of hitter I became in two strikes. You know, and it's helped me a lot because it made me a 300 hitter. But still, one time I was talking to Hank Aaron, and Hank told me, Rico, the type of hitter you is, you don't need to shot in your back. You can still hit 300 and hit 40 home runs if you want to. Because I look at you throughout the years, and I know that you is as good a hitter I have ever seen. You know, you don't chase the bad pitches, and but in my mind, I already developed the two-strike zone, the two-strike swings. So I could not go back in my mind, because I had to set up my mind or prepare my mind to do it again, all over again. So I prefer to keep on the way I was going, just get two strikes and just, you know, go to the right field. If it comes in, I pull it, you know. And there are lots of people mistaken with the inside pitch. That's the best pitch to hit to the opposite field. You do not pull an inside pitch. The pitch that you pull is the middle of the plate away. That's the pitch you pull. The inside pitch, if you pull it, it's going foul ball. So most of the time, the three quarter of the time, the ball that you always pull is the middle of the plate away. That's the ball you pull to your field. To the opposite field, the ball inside is better to hit to the opposite field. It's easy to hit. That's why you see a lot of hit and run fellows, we'd tell the ball, get in on top of them so they can hit it to the opposite field. You know, lots of people don't know that. They always say the ball always the best ball to hit to the opposite field. It's not. The ball in is the easiest place to hit to the opposite field.
That's why you hit so good.
You know.
You still hit the ball out of the park, though.
Oh, yeah.
Even with two strikes on it.
Oh, even with two strikes, I'll take him down.
Strong enough to go deep.
To the bridge and beyond. But I took away a lot of home runs from me because when I get two strikes, I forget the fence. See? And now I go for the long ball, the base hit. Get a piece of the ball and go for the base hit. But I was so dangerous that I could have, in two strikes, if you make a mistake, I can always hit it out of the ballpark. And that's how strong I was. But, you know, it's come down to the really gritty, like you say. It made me a better hitter. It made me a better hitter, and I got so confidence in me that I didn't think that no man in this earth could have thrown a fastball by me.
What's the most home runs you hit in the season?
31. And it was at the end of my career. Because I decided I wouldn't go, you know, half of the season, I was cutting down on my swing with two strikes, and then at that, I said, wait a minute. I said, I'm going for the long ball. And at 39 years old is when I hit 31 home runs.
Yeah. What 31 was that with?
Well, I was at Oakland.
Oakland?
Yeah.
That's a big ballpark.
Yeah.
Oakland. 31 home runs.
Yeah.
So you 39 see, years old.
Yeah, that's what Hank was telling me when I was 26 years old. He said, Rico, he said, why don't you just, you know, keep on as natural as I do? And I told him, I said, if I change, I might mess up myself completely. Because I don't think I can. He said, yes, you can. I've looked at you now for the past 3 years. And the way you select your pitches, you can hit without, you know, being in two strikes defensively.
Did Hank Aaron have a different grip of the bat?
Yeah, he sure did.
He had a grip like the good.
No. One day we was talking about that, and he told me, no, he said, Rico, I hit the same way you hit. They showed me to grip the bat this, but he says, I can't do it. I never did it. And I don't either. I hold the bat normally. Yeah, I couldn't hold it like that. I could never hit like that.
I couldn't either.
Yeah, with your knuckles, all the knuckles together, yeah. I couldn't hit like that. But I always hit like this. The awkward way. You know.
Like this.
Yeah, and Hank Aaron.
Let me see it again.
Yeah. See? I hit like that.
Okay.
No, lots of people hit like
this.
Yeah,
you know, I hit that same way.
Yeah.
I couldn't hit like this.
I can't hit like that. And, you know, he told me that one day.
With the knuckles together like this? Some guys, they look at their knuckles, they hit. I couldn't hit like that.
Yeah, I can't hit but with my knuckles together. You know, we sit down a lot of time, we start talking. And he told me one day, he said, Rick, you know something? And if you get 500 time at bat, in 375 to 400, using two strikes. So you is hitting from 20 to 25 to 22 to 16 home runs in 100 time at bat. So he says, if you go 400 time at bat without choking up in two strikes and protecting the plate, you can hit 40 home runs every year. And at the end of the my career is when I tried to do it, and I really did hit 31. And then I realized really that I could have done it.
Yeah, but look what you hit for an average. 330, 360.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right.
What's your lifetime batting average?
299. Yeah, they took away that pint from me. They should have given me that pint because they took away so many infield hits from me.
Yeah.
Because they said I couldn't run, you know. So any ball I hit over third base, or hit between shot and third, the shot stuff coming for the ball and none, so they give me an error. Any ball that they think that, you know, the shortstop was for third base could throw me out, or second base, they'll give me an error. So because of one hit, a fraction of half a hit, I think it was, they take away that 300 lifetime.
Yeah. How'd you hurt your knees?
I hurt my knee.
You run into an outfielder?
Yeah, but I hurt it here in San Francisco. That wet grass. I remember in 1965, I was feeling a ball.
Is that the first time you hurt your knee?
Yeah, that's when I first heard it. And I felt it there. And after that, I run in the wall in Milwaukee. Because that grass is damp over there, too.
But you hurt your knee. Yeah. Other knee that year?
Yeah.
The same one?
The same one.
Didn't you have TB, too?
Yeah, 1968.
Yeah, that's a lot of tough, didn't you?
I had everything. But I came over everything because You see, faith is everything. And I always set my trust in God. And I believe that anything a man wants to do, I think he can do it. It's faith. Faith that makes you overcome everything. Faith. And I believe in that.
I do too.
All throughout my career.
I didn't believe in it at first, but you want it,
then you can do it. You just have to make up your mind. What you can do is take advantage of your body. But you can do lots of things that can help your own self. Because I have seen players, I have seen those that are your singers, artists. You just get a headache and you want to just quit. And without, and doing that, you can hurt yourself so many times. And a lot of time you can help yourself by just saying, hey, I'm not sick. That headache is not going to bother me.
That's right.
His backache is not going to bother me.
You can heal yourself. Aching,
that's right. You can heal yourself. Your mind is so strong that you can dominate your own body. When you let your body dominate your mind, you're in trouble. See, and that's, I always think that, and that's why I think I've overcome all my illness that I went through. And I'm grateful to the Almighty God because I guess that power you have given to me dominate a lot of, you know, illness, sickness. I have went through so many things and I will overcome every one of them. It's the faith that I put in God and myself at the same time.
What is
TB? TB is tuberculosis. It's come from a cold. And
what does that do? Gets in your lungs?
It's getting your lungs, yeah, and it's like an infection.
So how did they treat that?
With rest and pills and...
So how did they treat that?
With rest and pills and...
But
the most important
weak?
Thing is rest. It make you weak, it make you cough a lot, you get a fever, you start sweating. Yeah, but all those
things...
It used
to be a fatal disease back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But at the time in the United States, it's had the cure in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that time. You know, so it didn't... It took me about a month almost to get almost rid of it. And I don't know if I really had the disease completely, but at the month time, they wanted to take me out of the hospital that I want, put me in a regular hospital. 1963.
Rodriguez Cabrillo.
Yeah. So,
how many years you playing in the big leagues?
16 years.
Wow. I'll get it for him. You getting your pension now?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, restroom in here?
I'm here with Ferguson Jenkins. Fergie, in your outstanding career from 1965 to 1983, you were known as a durable and consistent pitcher and usually led your team in innings pitched. To what do you attribute your ability to maintain such a high level of accomplishment for so long?
Well, starting basically in about December, I started thinking about diet, keeping my body in good shape. I used to work out twice a week, used to throw twice a week. And I got to the point where when I went to spring training, I was already at my playing weight, and all I had to do now was just concentrate on throwing strikes and just getting the body tuned up just a little more, because you know that in spring training you're in competition against half a dozen other pitchers on the ball club so you could be the number one starter, or you came off a good season so you wanted to repeat it. So consistency was a big factor that kept me going and kept me to the point where I always wanted to be the number one pitcher on the ball club.
And you were. What accomplishment in baseball are you proudest of?
Well, I won 620 season, with the Chicago Cubs, and pitching in a real small ballpark was, I thought, a challenge day to day. A lot of people look at it and say it was quite a feat, but I thought I was having lots of fun doing it.
Mm-hmm. What major obstacles did you have to overcome to achieve the greatness that you did?
Well, I played on some second division ball clubs. I played on some teams that weren't offensively as powerful in our division, especially teams like Pittsburgh and the Cardinals. I think that, and also the Mets. You know, pitching in Wrigley Field, you had to take advantage of the environment and pitch well. If you minimized your mistakes to one or two in a ball game, you could be a winner. But if you had more than one or two mistakes, I think that you have a lot of home runs, a lot of extra runs that basically made you a loser.
When you first reached the major leagues, did you have any idea you would be as successful as you have become?
Oh, no. I was hoping when I came in to the big leagues as a relief pitcher, I could possibly come up with 50 major league wins. And I did that within 2.5 seasons. And then when I really started to pitch well and win, I said, I got a chance to win 200 ball games, which I did. And then after that, it was kind of a goal to get to 250, and then when I got to 250, I said, I got a shot at 300, but unfortunately, the age caught up with me.
Is there anything about your career that you would change if you had it to do all over?
Well, there were a few times where I think maybe me asking to go to first division ball clubs kind of turned some people off. I know that right near the end of my career, when I was like 38, I wanted to play for either Milwaukee when they were in the first division or possibly the Dodgers, and unfortunately, the trades were just not made. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to play for a Canadian city, either Montreal or Toronto, which didn't happen.
That's too bad. What are the most significant changes in the game since you first arrived in the major leagues?
Well, there was just one Astrodome in Houston. Now there's about five or six dome stadiums now. And I think the biggest thing is a lot of AstroTurf. A couple of different years, the ball was fired up. Mm-hmm. There's a lot bigger bats. I think that the players are just as strong as they were, and they're just as good. But I think a lot of times the coaching, I think, at times is better. But I think that you now see a lot more power hitters on ball clubs compared to maybe just one or two back in the 60s and 70s. But there were a few ball clubs like Pittsburgh and San Francisco that had maybe more. But that was an exceptional team.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you see today's players doing that makes you shake your head in disapproval?
Well, a lot of pitchers. I think they're still throwers, really not pitchers. There's maybe one or two pitchers on a ball club. And some of these younger players are not keying on the older pitchers that have learned how to pitch, learned their craft, know how to set the hitters up, changing speeds, making the hitter do part of the work by swinging at pitches. And a lot of times, people that are they're playing are first ball hitters. They really don't know that in the lineup. So I think that they have to learn their craft maybe a little better.
Mm-hmm. What was your overall approach to pitching? Were you the kind of guy who challenged the hitter, or were you the kind of guy who tried to adjust to each individual hitter and pitch to the situation?
Well, I challenged the hitters. A lot of guys would come up and try to hit the first pitch off me because I threw lots of strikes. I didn't walk many people, so I tried to head that theory. I tried to challenge as many as I could. Plus, I knew what they liked to swing at and in what situations. And hitters always became anxious with the runner in scoring position, like second and third, or with two men on. They changed their approach to possibly hitting the ball.
Mm-hmm. You told me yesterday that you thought the toughest hitter that you had to face was Roberto Clemente. What made him so tough?
Well, Roberto was surrounded by really a good lineup. He had Don Clendenin hidden behind him, and he had guys like Mazeroski and Gene Alley and Al Oliver and Willie Stargell in the lineup, so that you had to basically throw him strikes or you had to face the power end of the lineup, because he generally hit third in the lineup or sometimes second, so that if you walked him, you had to face Stargell and Don Clendenin and Bob Roberts. So there was a powerful lineup behind him, so you couldn't pitch around a guy that had many guys behind him.
You pitched on several strong teams with talented players, but you never achieved a major league team championship. Why do you think those talented teams fell short?
Well, there were some times we were short on pitching. We had probably pretty good defense with Santo, Kessinger, Beckert, and Banks, and Billy Williams in the outfield, and Adolfo Phillips and Don Young. But we were always short on pitching. Kenny Holzman at times would only win 17 or 18 ball games. Bill Hands would win a few, and I would. But we had very little guys in the bullpen that were right now is, I think, the art of winning ball games. You have to have two or three good relief specialists. And at times when I played, we only maybe had one, Phil Reagan, 1 year, Abernathy another year. And I think we had, I'm trying to think of his name. His name slips my mind right now.
Okay. What are the major differences to a ball player in playing in traditional cities with high profiles like Chicago and Boston versus a newer baseball market like Texas?
Well, I think the people get a chance to know what you did and what you're capable of doing. And sometimes in Texas, if you were a first or second year player, they really didn't know what to expect if you were a streaky ball player or a fellow that was a lot more consistent. So I think it depends on the media. I know the New York media and the LA media really cover the ball players probably a little better than some of the other teams, like here in San Diego or in Milwaukee or possibly Kansas City. So I think it really depends on how good the press is to let these people know who's playing and who's doing what.
So you think intense media coverage is a more positive factor for the player?
Well, I think it'll enhance the player's ability. You know, he always wants to play well, but if he knows the people around him know that he's playing well, I think that makes him a little better player.
Of all the managers you played for, which would you hire to run a ball club?
Neil DeRosa, I think, was one of the smarter men that I played for. The late Billy Martin was very smart. Gene Mock was a very smart individual. I think that those three, over the course of my career, probably were a big influence for me.
How much influence does the manager really have on the team's success?
Well, I think during a period of a year, he might win a half a dozen or maybe a dozen ball games by making certain moves at certain times in a ball game, a pinch runner, a pinch hitter, especially late in the ball game when you have to have a hit with a pinch hitter, and he picks the right guy at the right time, that can win. But I think over the long haul, you're going to see who does what, especially in the bullpen. Relief pitchers are the guys that really save the ball games for you.
You came to the major league 17 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color line in baseball. Did you personally encounter any racial barrier in baseball, and do you believe there are still any in effect?
I never faced any. I think that I came to the big leagues and I was a happy-go-lucky individual. I just went out and played the ball. That's what ball game, and that's what I wanted to do. I think there is still some undercurrents. Guys that play on a ball club, and I'm not saying teams have a quota of number of Latin and black ball players on a team, but the most I've ever seen was Philadelphia. We had 12 one year, black and Latin players. Nowadays, you don't see that. Pittsburgh was another team that had that many Latin and black players. Now, there might be five or six, and in Boston, I think a couple of years, we only had two or three. So I think that every organization really looks at a player's ability, looks at who the individual is, and then judge accordingly, and then it goes from there.
Mm-hmm. One final question. How important
the Los Angeles Dodgers, Baltimore Orioles, Kansas City Athletics, Houston and Cleveland, and even have a stint with a minor league, San Diego Padres?
How important is it to you personally to be elected to the Hall of Fame?
Well, I think that the accomplishment that comes to you is a tribute after your career is over. And with the longevity that I had, I thought that there is some deserving factors there. If I got elected, I'd basically get elected for my father, because he didn't get a chance to play, and he played in a lot of Negro leagues in Canada and the U.S. So whenever I played, I was always performing for my father and myself.
Well, if I had a vote, I'd stuff the ballot box.
Thank you
very much, Ferdy. Really appreciate it.